Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on Fort William First Nation and Anishinaabe Territory in Thunder Bay, part of the Robinson-Superior Treaty.
And we're your hosts, J.L. Chung
and Carly Forbes. In this episode,
we have as many children, if not more children, being apprehended than during the residential school era.
Hands off Syria!
Hands off Syria!
Finally, I would like to share that I'm profoundly regretting that the panel does not include Indigenous members. Past and present governments have not appointed qualified candidates from your community for almost 20 years.
Reflections on child apprehension from Indigenous families. An emergency rally to denounce the U.S. bombing Syria in Montreal, and CRTC hearings to license Indigenous radio stations in Ontario, Alberta, and BC.
But first, here are the headlines.
The fentanyl crisis in British Columbia is continuing to get worse as the BC Coroner's Service released its latest numbers for deaths in March. According to the coroner, 120 people overdosed and died last month, while the number was only 79 in March of 2016 and 30 deaths in March of 2015. Though these numbers are for all types of drug overdoses, the number of illicit deaths when fentanyl was not detected has remained relatively stable since 2011. This prompted BC's chief coroner, Lisa Lapointe, to conclude that, quote, "The introduction of illicit fentanyl to the illegal drug market has had devastating results, with literally scores of our community members dying in their homes across the province," unquote. It has been 1 year since the provincial government declared a public health emergency related to illicit drug overdose. Gennargio Sullivan from Vancouver Co-op Radio spoke with Rob Smith on Access TV. Rob is a reporter with APTN Investigates and is working on a story on the fentanyl crisis in BC.
It's been described to me as being a war zone out there, and that's what you see when you get down there. People are suffering. People are going through trauma. People have been left behind. There's been so many deaths, and the question of what to do next is a pretty tough one, and there aren't really many answers out there.
While there are suggestions on how to address the fentanyl crisis, many critics are saying that the government is just not doing enough to address the situation, and the solutions are not as clear as we might think or want.
Well, certainly there's people who are saying the people who know that they're selling fentanyl are culpable in manslaughter or murder. It's interesting talking with the VPD spokesman there yesterday. He says the Vancouver Police Department considers this a health issue, that it's not a law enforcement issue. It doesn't help to bust the street level drug dealers because they'll just be replaced quite easily. So the way to go is to treatment on demand, and another solution that might not be palatable to certain through the politics is legalized pharmaceutical heroin. And I visited Crosstown Clinic, where they offer heroin pharmaceutically. So they come in and get clean heroin. They haven't lost anybody in this program.
Local activists and artists are also weighing in on the conversation and making sure that the fentanyl crisis makes it onto the May 9th provincial election agenda. Sarah Blythe, a local activist and artist, Brother Jopa, have created a memorial wall on 62 East Hastings Street, where people can post memories to those who have lost their lives to drugs in recent years. Blythe made it very clear that the memorial wall was a political statement ahead of the elections, saying, quote, "The idea is to create awareness during the BC election, to say that we're in an overdose crisis and that we need help," unquote. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Ome Salmarahim.
On April 20th, Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman began an annual walk for water along the shores of Lake Superior to the St. Lawrence Seaway. CILU's J.L. Chung interviewed Leanna Marshall, who will be joining Josephine on part of the walk.
Sure. So the water walk is
is being led by Josephine Mandaman, and she's, I think this is her third walk. I am not totally positive on that fact, but I know for sure this is going to likely be her last walk around the Great Lakes. And so Josephine has been walking around the big waters for a couple years now in ceremony to heal the water and also to raise awareness around the pollution in the Great Lakes. And she chose to do it out of ceremony. So she walks around and there's a group of people that walk with her. And so this time she's starting in Duluth, Minnesota. And I think the ceremony started yesterday on Wednesday. And she's going to start from there and walk underneath, I guess, the south part of the Great Lakes, of Lake Superior, and then come up through the Sioux, and then go over the top of the other ones and make her way to the St. Lawrence Seaway. And the reason that I've decided to go was because I had a vision, I guess just over a month ago, that was really powerful for me. Like it feels really life-changing. And so when I talked to Christy Belcourt about it, and she gave me some direction, and she suggested that I go onto this walk. And so I'm kind of, the way that things worked out with my kids and getting time off work, it actually worked out perfectly that I'm able to go on this walk. And I'm just going for 4 days. It's not going to be like Josephine will be walking for until, it's April now, and she'll be walking till July. So I'm going for 4 days. Just to put a context to this, I'm only going for 4 days. But I still feel really strong about going. I feel like the reasons why I'm going, it still needs to be uncovered. It will be something that will just happen, I think, quite organically. But I'm drawn to go to support her, and to support the water, and to support my children and my children's children. Like I feel when I was explaining to my kids, who are 4 and 5, what I was doing, I was saying to them, like, I'm going to be praying for you and for your kids and for just happy, healthy water and for just the benefits of water. So that's kind of where I'm going. It's a very simple reason, but it feels like I need to be there.
That's it for the headlines. Stay tuned to Groundwire for more community news from coast to coast to coast. We'll be right back after this.
On my wall, play.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station.
You just heard Rain by Nick Sherman from the album Knives and Wild Rice, recently nominated for Indigenous Music Awards Best Folk Album. Now it's time for our feature stories.
On April 9th, an emergency rally took place in Montreal to denounce the U.S. bombing of Syria. CKUT's intrepid 10-year-old journalist Yaffa Marouf reports.
4, 3, 2, 1, go!
Hands off Syria!
Hands off Syria!
Hands off Syria!
What is your name and what are you doing out here today?
My name is Marie Boti and I'm with a women's group called Women of Diverse Origins. And I'm here because I'm really afraid and I'm angry because of the U.S. attack against Syria. And I think it's very dangerous to accelerate war, the danger of war in the world. And I think it's important for people to take a stand and speak out about it.
I'm Tess, and I'm with also the Women of Diverse Origins, but also with the International League of People Struggle. And I'm here also to be in solidarity with the people who are saying that hands off Syria. It's very important at this time to have more people as possible to say no to war.
Why is being part of this protest today important for you?
Because there's been such a propaganda in favor of U.S. attack that, you know, people are confused. They think it's too complicated and they don't want to take a stand. So the more people that show that, yes, there's a main contradiction here, there's a main problem, which is attack on a sovereign nation right now by the number one imperialist nation of the world, the U.S., that, you know, this will help other people to understand that that's what the main issue is, you know.
And also to add that this might be also a start of going out and bombing other places, and we don't want that to happen.
What do you hope will change because of this protest?
The idea of a protest is to be seen and heard by people around us. And I think that, you know, there are quite a few people here and there's people going by. It's a good place. And I hope that, you know, the people who are exposed to it will, you know, start thinking about it and start looking into it and start, you know, also taking a stand about it.
And yeah, and also just to add our voice to the people who are here, but also really to have an alternative idea to what the people are hearing in the news. And I'm very happy that you are doing these interviews because this will add to the consciousness of having an alternative voice against the war.
My final question is, do you have any message for anybody?
Well, people who are concerned with justice and who are concerned with, you know, the rights of people, especially in the southern hemisphere, that they should take a stand and they should, you know, stand up against the aggressions of the United States.
Yeah, that people should come here, join the rest of us who are saying no to war.
Alors, est-ce que tu peux me dire c'est quoi ton nom et qu'est-ce que tu fais ici en ce moment?
Je m'appelle Joned Khan, Khan, K-H-A-N, et je suis ici pour manifester pour la paix et contre la guerre.
Joned, I told Yaffa that you were in Iraq. When the statue of Saddam fell, we just had an anniversary of that date.
Yeah.
How many years ago was that, and how different is this intervention from what was happening at the time?
That was exactly 14 years ago, in April 2003. How different is it now? The difference is, the attack on Iraq was mainly aimed at Iraq, and a frightening Arab opinion. The attack on Syria is aimed not just at Syria, but at Russia, at China, at the BRICS countries, and it's a message to terrorize the whole world. That's the difference.
Thank you to Yaffa at CKUT in Montreal for that report.
In February of this year, the Ontario Supreme Court ruled in favor of 60 Scoop survivors, finding that the federal government failed to prevent the loss of Indigenous identity of children forcibly removed from reserve communities and placed with non-Indigenous families. One of the key recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is to reduce the number of children in state care. Our next feature story discusses ongoing child apprehension in Indigenous families and communities. Gunarji O'Sullivan brings us this story from CFRO in Vancouver.
During the residential school era, the rate of child apprehension was enormous. In fact, there was a class action suit in 2007. We were given an apology for the taking of the children, and we were compensated, or at least some were. And now we're dealing with the 60 Scoop, right? And that class action suit. And now I think, seriously, come on. No apologies making any difference to the continued high rate of child apprehension. We have as many children, if not more children, being apprehended than during the residential school era. More of our children are being adopted to the point of no return.
My name is Robin. I'm Blackfoot and Blackfeet from Siksika Nation, Alberta. Automatically, I became a target. I became labeled because of my background, because of me being an intergenerational survivor, uh-huh. coming from a products of residential school. So automatically the way that my parents raised their children is automatically wrong.
So all taken into consideration. So when you were growing up with your mom, did Child and Family Services get involved with your lives back then?
Yes, they were involved back then. I was in and out of foster care, yeah. going through the court system.
See?
And now my kids are experiencing the same thing.
One child after another. In fact, you have three. You've lost one. So after you had your first child, they were already in your lives as you grew up. And you had a history, so they say. And did they take your first daughter and put her in child care or anything like that?
Yes, they had her in foster care for 6 months. But I was okay. able to jump through the hoops and basically comply.
How old was she when they took her?
She was about 1 year old.
Wow. And so you're still going through postpartum at that time?
I don't know if it's because I'm traumatized because of the apprehension, but now I feel that, you know, the ministry or somebody out there is always watching me or eyes for them or,
yeah.
you know, something like that. I have like a PTSD now because of that.
Yeah, no doubt. They probably traumatize you with each child that they continue to apprehend. And so you're continuously under investigation and being harassed by Child and Family Services with your first child. When did you have your second child and how old is the second one?
The second child I had in 2009 and that was Sahara.
Uh-huh.
And again, they were still involved. They had to come to my home and do a home visit and everything, you know, was okay. Up until like I would have periodic visits, yes. but I still had my kids.
Yes.
So the apprehension from there was when I got falsely accused for an assault out in Surrey, and I took it to trial. It almost took me 2 years to get to a trial. So by the time I got that trial date, they had found the video surveillance and had dropped the charges.
Okay.
But already the ministry had sunken their claws into my case,
yeah.
and I was already labeled as a dangerous offender.
Okay, and so had they taken your second child and your first child by
They
then?
Took my three daughters by
All
then.
All at once. Okay.
All at once.
Hi, my name's Helen Tommy. I'm from the Wet'suwet'en and Korean nation. I'm a former foster child myself, and my mother before me, my grandmother was in residential school. My daughter now is also in foster care, and I first had her when I was 19. I got pregnant with her, and then I was about 20 when I had her, and it was right from the hospital. They were right in there. Oh, someone has to come see you. And I was like, who? And they told me it was a social worker. So before my child was even home or even like born to the world, they were trying to assess my home right in there because I had a history of being an alcoholic because I ran away from my foster care. It wasn't the best. It was verbally manipulative. It was mentally manipulative, emotionally, and physically too. Like, it's not okay what they do to us or think that it's okay to have children's voices not be heard. Like, I was trying to tell my social worker for the longest time that I didn't want to be there, and they didn't listen. My mother is an extraordinary woman. She's so much strength and resilience that she made sure, even when she was broke on a dime, she had enough money to feed us and to clothe us. And for them to say that she was inadequate and she just because she went out a couple times to go and have fun, you know, yeah, I understand that alcoholism is a big thing in our community, but they have to understand that from intergenerational trauma, it's passed down to us from our elders and to our parents and then to us now. It's like the champagne tears. You pour the bottle on top and it goes trickling down the system, you know. It's lateral violence too. There's so many different things, systemic racism that is involved with this. They want us against each other, so we're not there to support each other.
Listen to the full interviews by Gunarji O'Sullivan on Klahauya Vancouver Co-op Radio.
You are still listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast, and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
Now it's time for our community radio report.
In 2015, the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, or CRTC, revoked the radio licenses for Aboriginal Voices Radio, thus opening the way for an application process for the licensing of 5 Type B native radio stations in Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Toronto, and Ottawa. Last month, the CRTC held a public hearing with applicants for licenses, as well as community members and advocacy groups. Courtney Harrop brings Groundwire the following community radio report from the hearing in Ottawa.
Canada's Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, or CRTC, released their 3-year plan on April 13. The plan is intended to provide Canadians with important information to prepare for and participate in the CRTC's public processes. The CRTC is a specialized government agency supervising and regulating Canada's communication system. The Commission makes rules and policy, but also has the quasi-judicial powers of a superior court. Chairman of the CRTC, J.P. Blay, spoke at a recent hearing about the role of the Commission in Canada.
As an outcome of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the Government of Canada wants to ensure the protection and promotion of Indigenous culture. The Canadian broadcasting system plays an important role in the reconciliation of Indigenous peoples with Canadian society more broadly. The Commission also raised the immediate need to serve the Indigenous community as a whole, since vital questions of importance to Indigenous Canadians are not completely covered, or not covered at all, by non-Indigenous media.
The latest 3-year plan includes reviews of old policies such as the Native Broadcasting Policy. Written in 1980 and last reviewed in 1990, the review of this policy has been on the last 3 of the Commission's 3-year plans. The 2017-2018 plan has scheduled to review this policy in 2020. The Native Broadcasting Policy will be 30 years old at that time. The 2017-18 plan also references the Cultural Diversity Policy, stating the CRTC will publish the results of its research and, if appropriate, initiate a public consultation to review its cultural diversity policy, including identifying issues with respect to multicultural radio licensing. Chairman Blay commented at the March 27th CRTC public hearing for 5 licenses about a concern raised by several groups in recent years, the lack of diversity within the CRTC since being established in 1968.
Finally, I would like to share that I'm profoundly regretting that the panel does not include Indigenous members. Past and present governments have not appointed qualified candidates from your community for almost 20 years. Unfortunately, there's nothing I can do about this, but time is of the essence and you need a voice to be able to continue on the road to reconciliation.
Kathleen Buttle, at a recent convergence on First Nations, Inuit, and Métis broadcasting, stated,
"While in operation, AVR was Canada's largest native Type B radio broadcaster with a total of 5 licenses, each in a major Canadian city. The CRTC renewed the licenses in 2006 and in 2010, and then offered short-term renewals from 2012 onward until the license was officially revoked in 2015.
At the public hearing, several groups shared their proposals of what they would do with an urban radio license, including the 40-year-old Wawate Communications Society. President Mike Metatawabin spoke about their plans for the Toronto and Ottawa licenses.
We want to be a part of that welcoming, that engagement with these new people, the displaced people that are coming to our countries. And we would like that honor to be first and foremost in welcoming these new people. For it wasn't their choice to be displaced. But they are being invited, they are being welcomed, and we want to share with them our history, our communities, our languages. Together we can create a new community to instill pride, culture, and an identity."
Originally, the 5 stations were Native B licenses requiring that they be run by Native undertakings as defined by the Native Broadcasting Policy. At the hearings, Chairman J.P. Blay stated during an interview by the Community Media Advocacy Center that he was not required to reissue these licenses to Native undertakings.
"Has legal counsel explained to you the principle of Article 6 of the Canadian Broadcasting Act, which says that a policy the Commission can, because it was recognized by Chief Justice Laskin and the Supreme Court, that the Commission can adopt policies, but it's just the Commission speaking out loud. They're not binding. We can always make exceptions to them. So you can't come here and say, well, first of all, it's erroneous on your part to suggest that we said that we would license only pursuant to that policy. That was an option, but not necessarily. But even if it was, the Commission can make exceptions to its policies. And in fact, it would be a jurisdictional error to be bound by its policies."
The Commission will make a decision on who will get the 5 licenses later this month, despite the outdated policy. To learn more about the upcoming CRTC Native Broadcasting Policy Review, check out the open source resources at indigenousradio.ca.
That was Courtney reporting on the recent public hearings by the CRTC to license 5 new Indigenous radio stations.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by Carly Forbes on Anishinaabe territory in Thunder Bay. Music this week was Rain by Indigenous Music and award nominee Nick Sherman from the album Knives and Wild Rice.
Headlines this week were written by J.L. Chung and Ome Sama Ramtula. We also thank Gretchen King, Gennardi O'Sullivan, Courtney Harrop, Yefa Marouf, and Saja Marouf.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.